This is News and Notes. I'm Ed Gordon. On today's roundtable, Ralph Nader defends using the N-word and the Supreme Court rules on the Ten Commandments. Joining us today from our New York bureau is Walter Field, CEO and publisher of the NorthStarNetwork.com. At member station WFDD in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, Nat Irvin, professor of future studies at Wake Forest University. And joining us from NPR West, our own Farai Chidea, who is back, many of you know, from her week-long cross-country road trip, and I hope well-rested. I welcome you all.
Thank you.
All right, let's start with what we just heard, and that was Ralph Nader. He's been in the headlines of late for his use of the N-word. Farai, I'm curious, you heard his explanation. What was your thought?
Well, I've spoken with Ralph Nader many times on the campaign trail, and like so many politicians, he just absolutely loves himself, so he can do no wrong. I don't think that sensitivity in this case is not his strong point, and I think that it seems very much like a publicity ploy.
Walter, he suggests that we shouldn't get our ire up, and the idea that he's a wordsmith and used it in its truest sense, its most illustrative and graphic sense, he admits, but he wanted to put his point across. Should you give credence to that much of it?
No, I think he couldn't be more wrong. You know, I've worked with Ralph in the past. I actually voted for Ralph Nader in 2000. But at the end of the day, Ralph is a privileged white male, and I think his attempts to identify with black oppression, you know, is akin to having Trent Lott wear kente cloth. You know, you just can't cross that line. So I'm really troubled by it, and I think it just breathes life into a derogatory connotation of black people. Is he actually suggesting that N-words exist? Because he's saying that I was treated like an N-word. Well, I want him to introduce me to an N-word, because I haven't met one yet.
Nat, well, you can find it in the dictionary, and it doesn't necessarily have to do in its truest form if we go to dictionary definition with race. But clearly, I think this country would associate it with African Americans. So that being said, let me get your take on it.
Well, I'd like to know whether he was using the ER version or the GA version.
I'm sure the GA version is ours, so let's just assume the ER version is what he uses.
Which I think, you know, illustrates the point. It's not a word that I use. It's not a word that was used in my household when I grew up. I'm 53. It has the worst connotations for me. It's not a word that my children will use, my parents have used. You know, when I see, and I heard Ralph Nader's explanation, and I can appreciate him trying to make a distinction, but it also sounds as if this is a person who's never had that word said to them in anger, you know, who's never heard, that word's never been hurled at Ralph Nader, as it has been if you are black and in my age. I mean, I have memories, I have vivid images of that term being used toward me and people like me, both violently, literally, and figuratively. And I don't accept his explanation. But on the other hand, I would also say this, too, that part of the reason we're experiencing this is because we have, in some parts of the black community, tried to take this poisonous word and ingest it and then try to come out with something that we call lovable. I think it's failed. I'm not one of those who thinks that the hip-hop generation should get a pass because they've changed the ER to GA. I think that what you see is that when you associate this word as it is widely used in the black community, it also comes along with that B word. It also comes with misogyny. It also comes with all of those harmful aspects that have helped to denigrate the image of blacks in America. So, you know, had Ralph Nader not had the history of being such a liberal, a Lebanese man, a Lebanese American, perhaps, you know, I'd be more outraged in one sense. In other words, if it were Trent Lott who'd said it, I'd be completely outraged. But I think just Ralph is just suffered from just having chosen the wrong word at the wrong time. There were certainly a lot of other ways he could have expressed himself. And I do take offense to anybody using that word. I don't care if you're black or white.
Farai, let me ask you, the idea of giving him a pass, I mean, there are others who, had they said that, African-Americans would have been up in arms. We see many communities, when offended, press for an apology. Is this something that black America should look to Ralph Nader to do? Should he be forced, quote, to apologize?
Well, you know, I think what's more interesting to me in this case, two things. One is, what's the intent? So if someone had used the N-word with the intent to defame black people, a lot of times, yeah, you want to ask for an apology. But to me, the intent here was to get publicity. That's not a great intent. I mean, that's a certain strategic use of the word that I find troubling for different reasons. Same way Paris Hilton, you know, putting out videos is kind of disturbing. He's just looking for publicity. But the second thing is that, you know, when you look at this incident, Ralph Nader has been talking about third-party politics. There's a lot of studies, you know, for example, studies by the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation and the Joint Center showing that a lot of African Americans, especially younger ones, would want some kind of third party or third way in politics. If this is a message that needs to be talked about, I don't know how much service he's doing himself or his message by making everything about the language. So to me, it's really a question more of publicity. And I'm not sure that the black community always should go around chasing an apology. It's a very reactive thing to do rather than a proactive thing to do. And maybe we need to spend some more time looking at, you know, the bedrock issues of facing the community as opposed to just always the language.
Walter Fields, I saw Reverend Sharpton last night and talked to him about this, and he was not surprised that Ralph Nader did not back down. Disappointed, I think it would be fair to describe. But what of the idea of what I asked for, Rai? Do you believe African-Americans should indeed chase down an apology? And if not, does it surprise you that we too often perhaps now see the black community not moved by any of this?
Well, it doesn't surprise me that an apology hasn't come forth, because there's never a notion that you have to apologize for anything you do to black people in this country. I would certainly want Mr. Nader to apologize. Am I going to chase it down? No. But I think it's tragic when you give the fact that he is trying to send a political message about independence and moving away from traditional partisan politics that could resonate in the black community. And that message clearly is lost by his use of this term. I mean, I also think it's sad that he says this after we've gone through like a 2 or 3 week period where we saw, you know, the body of Emmett Till exhumed. We saw, you know, a person put on trial for the murder of 3 civil rights workers. I'm quite sure that somebody called those people the N-word when they were being murdered. And that's what really offends me, because Ralph Nader can't understand that. Because he's never experienced that type of hate and anger in his life. And that's why I'm so offended.
Mm-hmm. Nat, before we move on, let me ask you, in terms of what Farai brings up, and I think what Ralph Nader has clearly done for almost upwards to 30 years now, and that is the idea of the introduction of real third-party politics. How feasible do you see that as something that could be realistic in the immediate future?
I don't think it's realistic at all. But I do think that it is important that the ideas are brought forward. I think that his last foray into national politics was basically in some ways it reminded me of a clown's act. It just was not to be taken seriously. And but, you know, that's just an opinion. But I do think the idea that he raises, the points that he makes about the stranglehold that the two major parties have on the political system, one, and number two, that the cozy relationships that exist between the two major parties and major corporations is real. And therefore, that there needs to be some destabilization of that. But I don't think that necessarily means that third parties are the way to do it. I just think the ideas of challenging the holes that the two major parties have on the polity right now needs to be challenged. And I'm not sure that Ralph Nader is the person to do it. I think that we need new voices. He's a part of a generation that spoke eloquently for some 30 years, but it is time for new voices, and I don't see how the N-word helps in moving that forward.
I should just say very briefly that I think that there are a lot of third-party elected officials on the local level, but his attempt to constantly insert himself into the national presidential runs definitely has not worked.
All right, and it's tough to do third parties.
Let's move our attention to the Supreme Court. A couple of decisions that we'll look at that came down yesterday. The first is the Supreme Court's ruling that governments can post the Ten Commandments on public property as part of a broader display of historic symbols, as long as officials aren't aiming to promote religion in the United States. And it was interesting because we saw them take a look at two cases, one they ruled for and one they ruled against. Walter Fields, what I find most interesting here is who's going to determine intent as relates to whether or not these symbols are on display to promote religion.
You're absolutely right. I mean, and pretty much this is just another ruling that confuses the issue of state and religion, you know, because it really is the public's interpretation of those symbols as they're displayed, because you can basically give any reason for displaying the symbols, but it's really how the public perceives those symbols. And I think it's clear in many of these cases that there is a religious connotation behind the display of such symbols. So I don't think the court did us a favor with this ruling. I think they just further muddied the waters.
Farai, both the rulings came down 5-4. We should note that the Ten Commandments monument on the grounds of the Texas State Capitol was rejected as unconstitutional in terms of favoring religion. In the second case, the 5-4 again, two Kentucky counties focused on promoting religion when they posted, this is again the words of the court, posted framed copies of the commandment in the courthouse.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more that it's confusing when you have two cases decided by razor-thin margins that seem to send different messages. I think that it's important to realize that, separation of church and state certainly is a tenet of American society, but there always has been some church in the state. The question is, how do we, negotiate that moving forward as a pluralistic American nation? I'm fascinated by some of the smaller signs that don't make it onto the radar of things like the Supreme Court, like in Dearborn, Michigan, which of course has a heavy Arab or Muslim immigrant population. They don't serve pork at all in the schools. No school lunches will contain pork. Now, that's not something that you've done by law. It's simply a recognition that if you have a lot of children who are trying to maintain Muslim dietary laws, that you might not want to serve pork. There's all sorts of evolutions around religion in American society, and the court, can only rule on so many of them. In this case, again, I don't know that it sent much of a signal because it's really hard to read the tea leaves.
Mm-hmm. Well, I actually am happy about the ruling 5-4. And I think that, as Faraya just pointed out, it's a reflection of a larger cultural war. Some describe as a war. I will say it's the evolution of America becoming not only multicultural, but multi-religious. You know, we have more Muslims than we have Episcopalians in this country now for the first time. And so it's the ruling by the court, I think, on the one hand, is likely to be viewed by the religious conservatives as a sort of a loss to the cultural wars, the battles, to say, you know, this is one more sign that we're going to hell. We have gay marriages. We have, in other words, it's a reflection of the symbolisms of the sins of the society, which is, you know, the fact that we're taking out our monuments. But I think also that as a Black American, two things. One, first of all, you know, as I've said before in other shows, I'm a son of a Baptist preacher. I'm a member of the Christian Fellowship. And so I certainly am not opposed to having the Ten Commandments as part of any public display. But there's another distinction I think that we can make, and that is I'm not so much concerned about whether those Ten Commandments are in the courthouse. What I'm concerned about, and I think this is where I think most Black folks would say, is how am I treated when I go into the courthouse? Do I receive the same treatment as do others when justice is rendered? And I think you would say that historically, if we were to think about the Ray Killen case, they probably had the Ten Commandments in the courthouse in 1967, but that didn't mean that anybody was convicted. I mean, we've had the Ten Commandments around for a very long time, but it doesn't necessarily mean that that translates into justice. So, on the one hand, this is about the loss of a certain heritage and the becoming more comfortable with our multi-religious heritage. But it doesn't change fundamentally whether or not you get justice in the court or not.
with just a couple of minutes to go, rather than move on to the other subject, which we wouldn't be able to cover with all three of you in a fashion that would be fair to the issue, I'm curious what we find here is the tenuous balance with the 5-4 to this court, and a lot of people are taking a look at that, Farai, with the idea that Justice Rehnquist may be moving on, and certainly in the next year or two, if not sooner, another Supreme Court member probably stepping down.
It's going to be a complete food fight because I cannot envision the Bush administration nominating a potential justice who does not have designs to constrain the access of abortion. And I cannot see the Democrats and even some of the Republicans supporting someone who does not support abortion rights. So I think that that is going to rear its head. The issue of abortion and reproduction probably are going to cause a full-on food fight. It could be something else. You know, it could be some other litmus test issue, including issues of church and state. But there is definitely going to be a long, ugly battle, I predict, over whoever is nominated.
Nat and Walter, with about 30 seconds each, literally.
I think it's going to be a battle. I don't think it's going to be long. I think the courts have long been lost. If you look at the lower federal courts, it's clear they have tilted significantly towards the right, and I think it's pretty much going to be anticlimactic once it happens.
Nat Irvin.
But, you know, there's always the chance that an Anthony Kennedy will somehow surface. And who knows what can happen in the future. It may look bad now, but I have hope for the future.
Well, on that optimistic note, we'll close out. Nat Irvin, Walter Fields, and Farai Chidea, thanks so very much for sharing your views on this day's roundtable. Appreciate
it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.